Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the Hell Money Podcast, broadcast from an undisclosed location in the San Francisco Bay Area. Looking out the window, we have blue skies. Checking the temperature, it is a balmy 74 degrees outside, but more like 85 degrees inside, because the Hell Money Podcast Studios is an oven, because things are hot in here. Things are heating up. They're spicy.
We're in hell.
Yeah, we're in hell. That's right. Yeah, that's right. I am Casey Rodemore. I'm here with my co-host, Aaron Redwing.
No, you can't say it. You can't dox it.
Bleep it. It'll be hilarious.
Just bleep it every time.
Yeah, just bleep it.
Okay.
Yeah, and here, before we launch into our topic, the node has synced. The Bitcoin full node that we started syncing last time.
I actually think we synced it the time before, because we did wartime Bitcoin.
That's right. So two times before, we started syncing this node, and it is sunk.
How long did it take?
Only like 24 hours.
24 hours. Now it's just been running in the background.
Yep. Yep. For a node to sync, it has to download every block, every transaction, and it has to validate every transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And transaction validation, it needs to do a lot of signature checking. Essentially. So it is like checking that all the signatures on all the transactions are valid. And that takes a long time.
Is this like a step towards being a sovereign individual?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. You just need to have your own Bitcoin node.
Do you need your own Bitcoin node to be a sovereign individual?
Well, I mean, yeah, from the strict point of view. Yeah, you do. You need your Bitcoin node. Mm-hmm. And whenever somebody pays you, you should check your own Bitcoin node to see if your transaction has been confirmed.
Yeah, that's sovereign stuff.
Like this node is really just like, if you run a node and you don't use it, you're not really supporting the network.
Mm-hmm.
When you run a node, it's like you're putting your economic weight behind that node's code.
Sure.
Right? If I'm running a Bitcoin node and I only accept transactions when that node says that those transactions have been confirmed, then that's sort of like putting weight behind the software that node is running.
And now, so are you going to leave this? Are you going to keep it running, or what are you going to do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually don't usually keep the node on my laptop running, but I'll turn it on when I need it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually use it all the time because Ordinals, the Ord Block Explorer.
Oh, you need to.
Yep. It connects to a full node. So we can actually, like, here, I can get the Ordinals Block Explorer out. CD SRC ord, make sure we're up to date, cargo run server, just run this bad boy, and then open it. So this is the Ordinal Block Explorer running locally. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it's out of date. Oh yeah, it just takes time to build up the blockchain. So the Ordinals Block Explorer needs to catch up to the full node.
Oh, okay.
But then now we can explore. Well, okay.
No, you can't.
Yeah, no, you can't. Now you could explore the Ordinals blockchain, if there wasn't some sort of bug or problem going on here.
Yeah. See, this is like, how long into each Hell Money podcast episode does it take for them to mention Ordinals?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
This one.
Yeah.
Pretty quick. We just went for it.
Yep.
Yeah, but it is relevant. So you need a node in order to get rare ordinals.
I mean,
or not get them, like, because you could just have them, right?
But that's right. Yeah, to know where the ordinals are, which ordinals are where, without having to trust anybody.
Sure.
Yep.
To be a sovereign ordinals individual.
Exactly.
I keep bringing up sovereign individual because Casey and I realized that we don't know what that like means.
Yeah.
And at this point, it's like kind of too late to ask.
Right.
You just have to like read the book.
Exactly.
I guess.
Yeah.
We tried even looking up like a summary, and it was just sort of like not helpful.
The thing is that the book talks about a lot. And so we were kind of looking for like, well, just tell us like what the theme is.
Yeah. Like what's
so
the
we can continue to pretend that we've read it.
Yeah.
But it was like, no, there's a lot going on.
Well, cause we were arguing, cause the vibe I got, I mean, now I'll just say it and then maybe someone can send us a boost on Found or something and tell me what a sovereign individual is. But my impression is that like the sovereign individual like idea is that like the future is going to be like kind of more like centralized and controlled, and there's only going to be some people that are going to have all of like the capability of like being an independent sovereign individual. And so that sort of implied like a kind of dystopic sort of future, right?
Right.
Whereas your impression was like not dystopic.
Yeah, just because I don't know and I haven't read it.
I know, it's fine.
I thought that maybe it was like, oh, like, not that the world is going to get dystopian and more centralized and more controlling, but that all of a sudden individuals could become sovereign. Have they could the liberate capability. Themselves from the crushing jackboot of the state that is on all of our necks all the time, that they could liberate themselves from that by, you know, new digital technologies that enable them to be more nimble and evade states and live where they want and perform regulatory arbitrage.
Right. So your interpretation was a little bit more like
salvation.
Yeah.
Salvation. And yours is like only escape from the coming darkness.
Exactly that. So yeah. I don't know. Someone. Somebody. We won't read. We refuse to read. No, we will. I'll read it. I have it downloaded on my Kindle.
It'd be a coup if we could get one of the authors in as a podcast guest.
That'd be cool.
Although one of them has passed away.
We could do a seance.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we could bill it as an interview with that guy. And people tune in with a clickbait. You know, we Photoshop his face in or something. Yeah. And then it's a seance.
It's just like me with a Ouija board being like, he says actually that I'm right about the sovereign individual.
He says I'm the sovereign individual.
So someone let us know. Today we're talking about Bitcoin mining. Did we already say that? I don't know,
but we're saying it now.
We're going to talk about Bitcoin mining. We have some like just general questions and topics that I wanted to ask Casey about. And then maybe we also have some demonstrations of Bitcoin mining.
Maybe. We don't know. It depends.
We'll see. We'll see where we go.
Yeah.
Before that, though, I did want to tell you.
Yeah.
So I had my first like Bitcoin dream, like a dream that
your first Bitcoin sex dream.
No.
Okay. Sorry, I just assumed.
I know. I mean, that is what it sounds like. Well, but I had remarked like a couple weeks ago, because I have a very active dream world. Like I'd be dreaming.
You do be dreaming.
And I like was like, huh, it's kind of weird that I haven't had any dreams that like Bitcoin, like feature Bitcoin in any way. Like, because I would think even just having like a casual stress dream of like price go up, price go down.
I have like programming Bitcoin dreams and they're always very bad.
What do you mean?
Like I'll be dreaming and I'll be imagining that I'm programming something like related to Bitcoin and I'm trying to get something to work or I'm trying to like figure out a way of doing something on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But because I don't have like my faculties, like I'm not like thinking straight because I'm dreaming. It's always very confused and muddy. They're almost like nightmares. They're not like
deeply scary. Yeah, it's like an anxiety dream. Like it's just like a little
It's like nothing works. I'm like, oh, I thought I had the transaction hash like right here, but it's not there anymore. And like I can't even see my keys on the keyboard. And like when I squint at the text, all the letters are moving around. And I'm
I think that, I mean, it's not anxiety because it's not like whatever, but it is sort of, it's like a disoriented, like kind of like, I can't do anything. Why can't I do anything? Like, I'm surprised I haven't had a dream like that or just like some sort of like benign kind of Bitcoin dream. Mm-hmm. But I had like a plot driven Bitcoin dream last night.
Yeah.
So in the dream, I was Frodo from Lord of the Rings.
Okay, all right. Does that make me Bilbo? Am I?
Would you be like Samwise or would you be Bilbo?
Oh, no. Maybe I'm Samwise and you're the protagonist.
Yeah, I think definitely. Because I'm also like more like Frodo. I feel like Samwise is kind of just like going about things and Frodo is like struggling with the ring the whole time. Yeah. And that kind of is our vibe. Like, I do feel like I'm like struggling with like things and I'm like, do you feel this? And you're like, no, like I'm just on my little hobbit journey through
Middle
Earth.
I'm just working on ordinals, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So I was Frodo in the dream and in the dream, I was like going through because Frodo like goes through Middle Earth or whatever and is like, on the quest to like get rid of the ring or whatever. And then there's all the other people that are like trying to gather people to like fight in the final battle and whatnot. I don't actually know Lord of the Rings that well, but like, that's my understanding of the plot so far as it like goes into my dream world.
Sounds right to me.
Yeah, I think it's generally right. So like I was Frodo and I was going through Middle Earth and I was trying to recruit people to like fight against like Sauron. I don't know, like the evil force. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to orange pill them in the dream.
Oh.
In the dream, that was what I was doing. I was so I went to the elf nation.
Uh-huh.
And in the dream also like the elf nation didn't really look like, they looked like me dressed up for the capitalism episode. Mm-hmm. Like they were kind of like a little more like cottagecore. Like they were having like a little party and like whatever. Cause I feel like the elves in like Lord of the Rings, the movies, like they're more stoic.
Uh-huh, right.
They're not really like what I was for like the capitalism episode where I was a little bit more like milkmaiden vibe.
Uh-huh.
So in the dream, they were like me in the capitalism episode, like drinking beer and being merry and like having a party. And I like happened onto their party and I was like, oh, like, can I talk to like the main elf, whoever the main elf is? And I got like a meeting with like whoever the main elf dude was. And I was like, hey, so like Sauron is really shitty. I don't know if you've heard about fiat, but like they be printing money and they have control over it. And it's really bad. And like, I really think that like as Middle Earth people, we need to like rise up and we need to like not let them just like print money. And I was like, and there's this thing called Bitcoin. Like we could all like if the elf nation wanted to like adopt Bitcoin and start using Bitcoin, then they could just do that instead of like participating in fiat. And like it could be a nonviolent form of resistance. Like you wouldn't have to like, I was like, I know that like, you know, usually you have to go to battle and you have to like lose all these men and whatever. But like this, you wouldn't have to. You just would have to like sort of get the elf people to start buying Bitcoin and using Bitcoin.
Right.
And he was like, nah, but the problem is that like we have quite a proximity to the printer, the money printer.
Oh, really? They're benefiting from the Cantillon effect.
Exactly. He was like, it doesn't really make sense for the elf nation to turn against fiat.
Right.
You should probably try your luck with the other hobbits. Yeah. Like the hobbits.
I feel like the dwarves would be the big, or like.
That's the plebs.
Yeah.
The dwarf nation.
Or are they like too into like gold and jewels?
But that's kind of a similar, as far as Middle Earth is concerned, like who would be the Bitcoiners of Middle Earth? Definitely like the dwarves, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, no. I mean, because the dwarves are kind of the money printers because they're like, they've got the mines, right? Like they've got the mines of Moria. They're digging gold and gems out of the earth.
They could be the Bitcoin miners, like, you know?
Yeah, but they're not.
Okay, but who's the Bitcoiners in Middle Earth?
Men.
Just general men.
Just yeah, the humans. Men. Humans are the Bitcoiners on Earth. We're the Bitcoiners here. We're the Bitcoiners on
Earth. We're the Bitcoiners in my dream version of Middle Earth. Yeah. It's like abstracted from like what the Lord of the Rings actually is. But yeah, I was not successful. I was really disappointed. I was like, fuck. Like I didn't manage to get this elf nation to go. They were just like, sorry, bro. Like it doesn't financially make sense for us. Like you got to move on to another nation. And I was like, shit. And then the dream ended.
Mm.
Isn't that a weird dream? It's like so specific.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really believe dreams have any significance.
Oh my God. You're an
idiot. Yeah. 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 I think dreams are just like your brain juice that accumulated during the day squirting around and you're like neurons firing.
Why? Why would it be that? I mean, okay. Let's even say that.
Why would it be that?
Why? Let's say it's that. Let's say that it's like just brain juice.
Yeah.
Don't you think it still has some indication of like things that you think about in your normal life?
Yes. I think that when you think about things a lot, you tend to accumulate brain juice
in related that area to those, of in your that brain. Area.
Yeah. And then when the pressure equalizes, if the brain juice like squirts out.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
I don't think that makes it so that you can't analyze it, because I think like if you have a dream where you're doing something that you think about a lot in real life, like I feel like when you're dreaming, your psychological defenses are down. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like you're more likely to just like have a sex dream about someone and be like, oh God, like, what was that about? Uh-huh. Like, like, whereas in real life, you might not like consciously choose to like daydream about that person or whatever.
Sure.
Like,
yeah, totally.
So I think like dreams, okay, let's say like even in the most like anti-dream interpretation perspective, I still think that dreams like are an indication of like what the soup that's sloshing around in your brain. And like, if you take the time to look at it, you can be like, oh, like, this is something that like my conscious mind doesn't really want me to acknowledge because I'm like embarrassed of it, or it's like weird,
but is it
or
really
whatever.
A newsflash that you've been thinking about Bitcoin a lot?
Well, it's significant that I haven't been dreaming about Bitcoin because I've been thinking about Bitcoin.
So maybe this represents Bitcoin penetrating a new layer of your subconscious.
Clearly. Yeah. Clearly. And I think that
making it a bit of a sex dream.
I mean, yeah, maybe all, I mean, all dreams.
All dreams are sex dreams. Freud thinks all dreams are sex dreams for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not like super, I don't believe in the idea that like symbols and dreams are universal. Like, I don't think it's like, oh, well, if you saw this in your dream, that means this. Cause it's like, no, it is dependent on like your perception of whatever thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that you can like interpret things in the dream and be like, oh, like, this meant this to me. Like when I think about this thing, my first reaction to it is this emotion or this memory or whatever. And so like you're just like reflecting upon that. Maybe you don't believe that there's like significance in you processing that. I think there is. Like, I think that it's like a safe time for your brain to like process things, or like it's a time when your defenses are down and your brain is like able to process things. But yeah, I don't think like, Freud, I think, wanted to like basically create like a dictionary and be like, if you see this bird, that means like whatever thing, it means you want to fuck your dad.
Yeah, he was really into birds.
Yeah.
And fucking your dad.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't believe that kind of thing, but I do find it interesting and like useful personally to dissect my dreams, partially because they are very like animated, like Lord of the Rings, orange pill. But yeah, it's I don't know. What's that about? Like a bunch of like versions of me during the capitalism episode partying and not caring about Bitcoin, you know?
Oh yeah. Right.
That's kind of weird.
Yeah. There, but for the grace of God, go you.
Therefore, by the grace of
Therefore, God. But the grace of God.
But the grace.
Like that could be you just partying near the
That's
money
what
printer.
I think. I think that's kind of what it was. It was like, oh, like we don't care about that over here.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, what? Like, why don't you care? I'm just this little Frodo, you know? Yeah, so that was my Bitcoin dream.
Really make think.
It really did make me think. You know, listeners, let me know what your analysis.
Write in with your analysis of Aaron's dream.
Like, I'd love to hear it, honestly. I'd love to get some secondary opinions or, yeah, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that was my Bitcoin dream.
Cool.
Yeah. Should we talk about mining?
Yeah, let's talk about mining.
Okay, how do you want to get into this?
I want to get into it by saying that this is kind of the counterpoint of all the stuff related to Ethereum and Ethereum's proof of stake.
Yeah, we've been talking about Ethereum a lot recently.
Yeah, and talking about proof of stake and talking about its trade-offs and not really talking about why mining is, what mining does for Bitcoin, why mining is necessary, what part of the equation that it solves.
I mean, that's definitely useful because I think a lot of people don't get it. Like, obviously, Bitcoiners understand, like, they believe in proof of work, otherwise they wouldn't be Bitcoiners. But I think for anyone outside who's sort of looking at like cryptocurrency, they're like, well, why not just make it environmentally sustainable? Why not using a lot of energy?
Right.
So I think like cohesively making that point.
Yeah. And mining is the core innovation of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I would say if you had to take any one piece of Bitcoin, which part of it is the innovation or the new idea that made this whole system possible? And it is mining. It's proof of work. Mm-hmm. So I should say proof of work was invented before Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin made use of it. But specifically, it's assembling transactions into blocks, processing those blocks, and requiring that they meet a certain level of difficulty and automatically adjusting the level of difficulty that they need to meet over time, depending on how many miners are in the network.
So like when Ethereum was proof of work, was it similar?
Yeah, totally similar.
And so they
it had a lot of differences in the details and the proof of work algorithm that it used specifically. But in general, yeah, the proof of work was just proof of work.
What other proof of work cryptocurrencies are there?
I believe that Zcash is still proof of work. They want to move to proof of stake, but it's still proof of work. And Monero is proof of work. Which is a privacy coin. But they don't want to require special hardware to mine. And so they are kind of have this position that they're going to change the proof of work as necessary to make it impossible to mine with ASICs, with specialized hardware.
Why can't it be specialized?
They sort of want everybody who has a computer to be able to mine, Monero.
So like more accessible.
Yeah, which I do think is noble. Mm-hmm. I think the intention there is good, but I don't think the trade-offs are worth it.
That was one of my questions that I wanted to get at is like mining decentralization and like mining pools.
Right.
Like if you can't just be like a Joe Schmo at home mining, like why does that make it not? Like, how is it still decentralized?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, let's get back to that in a second, because I just want to talk about like the soup that Bitcoin came out of.
Okay.
Bitcoin was discovered by Satoshi Nakamoto, who wrote this white paper. And the white paper has a lot of references and it mentions a lot of other systems. I don't actually remember what the specific references are. But for example, there was a system that it referenced called B-Money by a guy named Wei Dai. And B-Money essentially was like Bitcoin, but with no mining and no blocks. You just had nodes. They you would make transactions and these nodes would just broadcast them to each other. And so you couldn't really resolve double spends very well. Mm-hmm. You sort of, it worked as long as everybody was being honest, but as soon as somebody started to be dishonest and broadcasting conflicting transactions, for example, spending money in two different ways such that only one of them can be valid, the system kind of breaks down. But it was a previous, you know, research effort to do a Bitcoin-like system. And Wei Dai was very open about that in the paper. He was like, yeah, like you can kind of do this, but it's got these problems. Like this is just sort of a contribution to the literature. Then there was proof of work, which was by Adam Back. I think proof of work has come in a few different formulations, mm-hmm. but Adam Back's is the most prominent with what he called hashcash. And hashcash was a way of proving, it was just a way of proving that you would put a lot of computation into a message in a way that it was easy to verify that that computation was done, but hard to forge that computation, hard to do it. So the way that you do it is you take a message, like a digital message, and then you hash it. And a hash function produces a big number with random probability, say between 1 and 1,000,000. And if the number is greater than, let's say, 100,000, you hash it again, right? So if the hash function is random number between 0 and 1,000,000, and you get the hash function such that it's below 100,000, mm-hmm. that means that you probably did at least, we'd expect that it took you 10 hashes to try to get that message with that low hash. And between each hash function, you like modify the message such that when you hash it again, you get a different hash. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of Adam Back's proposal. I don't know if Adam Back proposed it, but he suggested that it be used for email spam. And the idea is that before sending an email, you would hash it repeatedly until the hash of the email was below some low number. And then when you sent it, servers could tell that it was it had been costly to produce. And this would help with spam because spam exists because messages are very cheap to send. Email spam exists because messages are cheap to create and send.
Right.
They're just digital and they just go over the internet. So if you make them costly in some way, mm-hmm. then that would help with spam. If somebody's put a lot of energy into the message, that means that who knows if the content of the message is good, but at least they can't do this and send this to a whole bunch of people. Mm-hmm. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Yep. So one interesting problem with hashcash is how much work do you require everybody to put into a message? Like, where do you set that difficulty level?
Right.
Do you require, if a hash is a number between 0 and 1,000,000, or let's say 0 to 1,000, do you require it be under 100? So you have to do on average 10. Do you have it be under 10? Which in that case, you have to do 100 iterations of the hash function. Mm-hmm. Do you have it to be under 1 or 0, in which case you have to do 1,000 iterations of the hash function? So that's sort of a question of an open sort of problem with hashcash. It's like, well, how difficult do we make it? Mm-hmm. And I mention that because then we have Bitcoin, which kind of marries these two bits of tech. It marries Wei Dai's B-Money, which has no way of ordering transactions and no way of dealing with conflicting transactions, and we marry it with hashcash. And the core sort of innovation of Bitcoin is, instead of just broadcasting messages to each other and just accepting that those messages are done once we get them, as you do in B-Money, we say no. Nodes broadcast messages to each other, but they are not final until they are included in a block. And a block is basically just a big collection of messages that has to meet a hashcash-like difficulty target. So it means that what the miners do is they collect a bunch of messages and then they hash that bundle of messages. And if the output of the hash function, the number, is lower than the current network difficulty target, then that is a valid block. And it's above that difficulty target, it's not a valid block. Mm-hmm. And they have to do many, many millions, billions, quadrillions of iterations of the hash function in order to find a valid block. And when a miner finds a valid block, the miner broadcasts that block to all the other nodes in the network. And nodes have a rule that they consider the longest, the heaviest valid chain. And when I say heaviest, I mean with the most work, the most hash iterations have gone into this, most calls of the hash function have gone into this chain. Mm-hmm. The heaviest valid chain they consider to be the canonical like chain tip. Like that's the state of the world.
Okay.
And the transactions that are in that chain have been processed. And any people who have been paid by those transactions have been paid. Those UTXOs exist. Unspent transaction outputs exist. And any transaction that's not part of that chain simply hasn't happened. And then there's the difficulty adjustment, which is how does that difficulty target get set? That number that when you hash a block, the output of the hash function has to be below that number. When the difficulty target gets lower, hash mining gets more difficult mm-hmm. because you have like a narrower space of the hash function output that you need to hit.
So you're basically, so the difficulty adjustment just means that over time it gets harder to mine.
Doesn't get harder. When miners, so basically Bitcoin tries to keep the blocks coming on average once every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so every 2 weeks, which is a difficulty adjustment period, Bitcoin goes, okay, let's look at how fast the blocks were coming in the previous 2 week period, or actually 216 block period, which is about 2 weeks. And if they were coming faster than on average once every 10 minutes, then Bitcoin increases the difficulty to bring the time back up to on average every 10 minutes.
Okay. And so that then is dependent on like how many people are mining.
Yep. And how efficient their hardware is.
So it's an adjustment to like current conditions basically, rather than being like, it's just getting harder.
That's right. Yeah. And the difficulty goes up when new miners enter the network or miners get more efficient or they get new hardware, or it goes down when miners stop mining or there's like some, you know, disaster. Like quite notably, I think last year, maybe there was, you know, China finally banned Bitcoin for real mm-hmm. and they made all the miners leave. And there was a big downward difficulty adjustment.
Right.
Adjusting to all those miners stopping mining.
So the difficulty adjustment just adjusts, but it does happen that, you know, I guess with increased adoption and increased computational
increased value of Bitcoin,
right,
miners are gonna, it's gonna be, it will worth become more to contend difficult for those mining rewards,
right?
And so miners will buy hardware, they'll make more efficient hardware, they'll cool their hardware better mm-hmm. and then they will the more hashes, blocks will come faster, and then the network will adjust,
right? So the difficulty adjustment can adjust in either direction, but mm-hmm. over time often it will become harder.
Exactly. That's correct. Yep
cool.
Yep. And so the initial idea of Bitcoin, Satoshi actually used this in the paper, was like one CPU, one vote. I actually don't know if he said that in the white paper, but I know
pro democracy.
Yeah, pro democracy. Yeah, really hurts me to say that. But yeah, Satoshi seemed to have been a democracy stan. Mm-hmm. But what happened very rapidly is that it turns out, so, and the Bitcoin proof of work function is double SHA-256, which is a standard, really common hash function. And it just turned out that you could compute those hashes that you have to do in mining way more efficiently on GPUs mm-hmm. than CPUs. So broadly speaking, the history of Bitcoin mining can be divided into a few different eras. And the first era was the CPU mining era. And that was an era where you could just get Bitcoin running in your computer. And if this computer, if we were back in 2009, this computer would be mining Bitcoin right now. Mm. It would be trying to find a block just using the CPU, and my computer would be getting really hot. The fans would be blowing.
So at what point did that become impossible?
It became impossible pretty quickly. I don't want to say exactly when, but I know within like a couple, 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
Basically because GPUs are already commodity hardware. Everybody can get a GPU. Mm-hmm. And GPUs are way more efficient than CPUs. Mm-hmm. They can just churn them out turn those hashes out way faster.
Sure.
And Satoshi actually said that we should have a gentleman's agreement not to start GPU mining just because it'll make it too hard to mine.
Oh, Satoshi, you should know better than a gentleman's agreement.
I know. Yeah. Aside from being very problematic, I think it's just kind of a fool's errand. I think it's just
incentive structure, bro.
Yeah. And then also you have the problem where anybody who's following the gentleman's agreement will be less competitive than anybody who defects from the gentleman's agreement.
Yeah, I feel like you can't. Yeah, come on, Satoshi.
Yeah. But despite Satoshi's best efforts, and he didn't really like, you know, he didn't really suppress it. But despite Satoshi's best efforts, then we entered the GPU mining era, era where you could just get a bunch of GPUs from the store and hook them up and mine Bitcoin. And then the next era was the FPGA era. And let me say what the era after that is. There was the GPU era, the CPU era, the GPU era. GPUs are graphics cards. Usually they're for playing games, but they're very highly parallel, so they can do a lot of things at once. And then we have FPGAs, and then ASICs. ASICs are application-specific integrated circuits. So they're integrated circuits, ICs, microchips, that are specifically built to mine Bitcoin.
Maybe Satoshi was just a gamer, and he didn't want people getting all the GPUs and running up the price for his gaming equipment.
Exactly, he knew that would be unpopular.
He was like, come on, guys, don't.
So then FPGAs are kind of this intermediate step between between general purpose hardware like a GPU or a CPU and specialized hardware. They're essentially hardware that is reconfigurable. You say, hey, I want you, they're like Protean, you know, they can kind of be anything. And then you tell it like, okay, like be a Bitcoin miner. Mm-hmm. And it can kind of reconfigure itself into a Bitcoin miner, but not as efficient as if you build a Bitcoin miner from scratch. Mm-hmm. And I believe that FPGAs were about as fast as GPUs, but they saved a lot of energy. And then ASICs are way faster and way more efficient than FPGAs. And these days, we are currently in the ASIC era. Everybody mines with ASICs, which are application-specific integrated circuits. They're purpose-built mining hardware. And none of the other mining technologies, neither CPUs, GPUs, nor FPGAs, are efficient to mine with at all. You just waste money because you'll burn more electricity than you'll make in Bitcoin.
What if you are like super bullish and you're like, well, my electricity costs are nothing compared to how much this Bitcoin will be worth in 10 years.
But then instead of burning through electricity that costs you $100 to get $10 worth of Bitcoin, you just buy $100 worth of Bitcoin. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, I often see people be like, oh, like, you know, this sat isn't really worth it. These few sats aren't really worth it very much, but think about the amount they'll be worth in the future. But it's like, no, like if you really want to stack Bitcoin, get a job that pays a ton of money. And which is not as fun as like, you know.
As being a miner,
yeah. Like routing Lightning Network transactions.
It's not as fun.
No.
And you're not defending the network.
You're not defending the network. No. Well, I don't know. I think number go up is an important part of Bitcoin. So buying Bitcoin makes the number go up.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe defending the network is priceless. You know, getting to be a part of the.
I feel like maybe you could put a price on that. I think you could, you know.
You can definitely put a price.
My economist hat.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now we're in ASICs era.
Yeah. And then the other important thing to talk about is to talk about pools. What is a mining pool and why do mining pools exist? Mm-hmm. So when you are a Bitcoin miner and you find a block, you basically, the way that you modify the block such that the next hash function is different from the previous hash function is there's this field called a nonce, which stands for number used only once. And you just increment it. So it starts at zero, you hash it. And if you get a valid block, great. You just got a block reward. If it isn't a valid block, you increment it by one. So it goes to one and then you hash it. Was it valid? No, keep going. And so you just increment this number over and over again until you find one that has a valid hash. And that's called like a golden nonce.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So miners are trying to find a golden nonce. And one problem with this is that if you have a relatively low proportion of overall hash rate, you will find blocks, but your variance will be very, very, very high. So let's say that you're a miner and you have, you know, 10% of the hash rate. You're going to find on average 14.4 blocks a day, because that's how many blocks there are per day, 144. Once 24 hours divided by 10 minutes is 144. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be fine. You know, you're going to get on average 14 blocks every day. Maybe you'll find one more or one less or a few more or a few less, but you're okay. And you just sell it and you pay your electricity bills. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say you're a miner that has 0.001% of the hash rate. On average, you're only going to find a block, you know, once every like, year, maybe, or even more than that. Let's say you're 0.1% of the hash rate. So on average, you're going to find a block. We'd have to figure it out, but like it's going to be very infrequent.
Yeah.
Right.
You just be like, honey, I did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that block is going to like subsidize your, let's say you're
that's on, your whole.
Yeah. Let's say you find on average a block once a year. You have enough hash rate to find a block once a year. So, well, that is going to have to pay for all your electricity costs for the entire year.
Right.
So, you know, if you've gone, and also maybe that means you'll on average find one block a year, but you'll go a whole year without finding a block. Mm-hmm. And like next year you'll find like two blocks.
Right.
You know, but you've already gone out of business in year one because you didn't find anything that year.
Right.
So your variance is very high, right? The variance of your rewards are very high. So what miners do is they band together and they form pools where they all mine collectively and they agree to share the mining rewards. Mm-hmm. And this reduces your variance.
Right.
So that you get, you know, the pool, you have 0.1%, you're finding one block a year, but the pool together is finding 10 blocks a day. And so the pool has very low variance and then it shares the wealth with its members. It shares that out evenly depending on how much mining you did. And so then you get paid out proportion to your hash rate, to your proportional share of the network's hash rate,
right,
but with low variance. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so almost all miners are pool miners. Everybody's in these big like shared mining pools.
I mean, are there trade-offs to that? Because I feel like I always see so much drama about like mining pools and people just being like, oh, you're getting scammed and blah, 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 whatever. Like,
I think you're thinking about something different from mining pools. I think you're thinking about hosted mining or cloud mining.
Okay.
So that's when the standard way to use a mining pool is where you have your own mining hardware, but it's like pointed at a pool and you're sharing the pool's rewards. Mm-hmm. I think what you're talking about is when you pay somebody to host miners in a facility on your behalf. Like, for example, like Compass Mining, which was a recent, you know, disaster where they said they were mining on people's behalf and then you didn't get your money, you didn't get your machines and they folded and it was all very sketchy. And that's not the first time that's happened, like literally like a dozen or two dozen different times before that there's been some hosted mining product that's just like self-immolated.
But if you're physically like you have the hardware and you're just a part of a pool, not as much of an issue scammer wise.
Yeah, that's right. Because the pool should be paying you out fairly frequently. And if the pool doesn't pay you out, you just switch to a different pool.
Right. Yep. Okay.
And that's something that should be emphasized, that it's easy to switch pools. But you know, pools are the more centralization that we have in pools, the less decentralized Bitcoin is.
Yeah. Like what's the reason to have different mining pools, like to be a part of one pool versus another?
Well, one is that you don't want one pool to get very big because then that pool would have to start censoring, could have the ability to censor transactions.
Right. 51% attack or whatever.
Exactly. When a mining pool, the way that a mining pool works is that the mining pool creates the block template, which is the block header that sort of commits to all the transactions that are going to be in the block. And then it like farms out that template and different ranges of the nonce to different miners who all like hash the same template. But the mining pool has selected what transactions are going into that block.
Sure.
So just like a solo miner who had 51% of the network, they could start attacking the network, trying to roll back blocks, trying to double spend, censoring transactions.
So besides just like not letting one or a couple have major power, like what would be the reason to pick any one mining pool over any other mining pool, like from a miner's perspective?
They have different payout schemes. So different ways of calculating your share of the reward that you should get. There's like maybe like a dozen or more different weird payout schemes. Then there is competition. They charge fees. Like their businesses, they're taking some of the rewards for themselves. And so they compete on fees. So maybe one charges a lower fee. So you'd want to do that. There's different levels of like integration, different levels of, some of them do like analytics. Some of them are, you know, pro whatever. I don't know. So
could you just have a mining pool with like your friends? Like if you had like 100 friends,
you're
all mining, could you just have a pool where you all just split it equally and there were no fees?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess it would depend on it to accomplish the goal of a mining pool, to do what a mining pool is there for, you would have to have enough friends that your overall proportion of the hash rate was high enough such that you had low payout variance.
Right.
Right. But yeah, once you have enough hash rate, then you can have your own mining pool.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Goals. How many pod?
How many podcast mining pool? Yeah. That'd be a funny way to like take donations. It's like, listen, we have a mining pool and we don't pay out any rewards. But if you just like feel bad for us, you know, you could just point your miner at our mining pool. Just point your miner at the pool. Help.
I think at that point,
pool.hellpodcast.money.
I mean, to quote what you just said, I think at that point, if you want to support us, you just buy Bitcoin and send it to us.
Right.
Rather than pointing your miner at our mining pool.
Might be inefficient. Yeah. And there was actually a point in the past where one mining pool, I think it was called Ghash.io, briefly got more than like 50% of the hash rate.
Drama.
Yeah. So that there was much like
someday Hell Money podcast.
One day we'll be the source of the drama. But then nobody liked that, and so they switched pools, and probably Ghash like made people switch pools because they didn't want that heat. But you know, in the end, you can't tell who controls a mining pool.
Yeah.
So you could have two pools that are 25% of the hash rate, and you think that you think they're separate entities, but there's no way to prove that they're separate entities.
Mm.
Yeah. And there, a lot of them are or were Chinese, and there was a lot of like interlocking relationships.
Yeah.
And so it was hard to tell what, like, it's likely that, you know, we had sort of like a Zaibatsu, like interlocking, like relationship situation with Ghash, and when it dropped below 50%, it actually was like
still connected.
There are other pools that had
an oligarchy.
But one thing that needs to be emphasized is that switching pools is cheap. It's free. It's instant.
Right.
You can switch pools instantly, and miners often do that as a part of their normal operations. They might mine on multiple pools.
Hmm.
So, if a pool started misbehaving, all the miners could just switch to a different pool instantly, right, and with no cost. And in fact, the miners have a lot to lose if somebody starts attacking Bitcoin.
Right.
They have all this hardware, all these resources, all this space, all this specialization, these buildings, these techs, everything. And the value of those things all depends on the value of Bitcoin. And so if somebody starts successfully attacking Bitcoin, the value of your ASICs go down. Right. So of course you're going to switch pools.
Right.
One thing that's very frustrating is people often compare the number of pools in Bitcoin to the number of validators on Ethereum, as if they're similar. They go, well, like Bitcoin's not decentralized. Like, look, you've got these like six pools or whatever, or nine pools or however many it is that control 51% of the hash rate. And you've got like nine validators on Ethereum that can control. Well, in Ethereum, you've got four validators, mm-hmm, and they go, look, nine and four, it's not so different.
Yeah.
But that's really a uninformed or disingenuous comparison. As I said, pools are very easy to switch between. If, mm-hmm, a pool is misbehaving, you can switch to another pool instantaneously. However, validators, they actually hold your coins. And if Coinbase is misbehaving as an Ethereum validator, and you go to withdraw your coins, they can just say no.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Or they can, you know, hem and haw and be like, oh, sorry, bro, you can't give your coins right now.
Yeah.
And so it's not an apples to apples comparison.
Right.
And in fact, Bitcoin is getting more decentralized. There's a protocol called Stratum V2. The current mining protocol is called Stratum, and that's, mm-hmm, the protocol that miners talk to their pools with. Stratum V2 is an upgrade that fixes a bunch of things. Stratum V1 has done a great job, but it's pretty messy, pretty insecure. And one thing that Stratum V2 does is that instead of the pool choosing which transactions to include in a block, the miner does. So every miner can construct their own block template. And this removes the pool as a source of censorship.
Mm-hmm.
So if all the miners on the pool are selecting their own transactions, and the pool doesn't pick and choose which transactions get into a block, then it doesn't matter if a pool has, you know, 60% of the hash rate. I'm sure there might be other reasons why that's not desirable.
Ideal, yeah.
Like it could be attacked or whatever, but it doesn't have the ability to centralize. It doesn't have the ability to censor or attack the network.
Hmm.
Yeah. And Stratum V2 looks like it's going to make it. I thought that Stratum V2 had NGMI vibes for a while, that maybe mining pools wouldn't be incentivized to adopt it. Mm-hmm. But I actually think mining pools don't want to select transactions. You might think that a mining pool wants to select transactions, right? They want to have that control over what goes into blocks.
Sure.
In reality, I don't think mining pools want that. I think they just want to collect their fees and not have any drama about them getting too large.
Right.
And they also don't want the government telling them that they have to censor things.
Yeah, they don't necessarily want to be in a position where they can do that.
Even. Yeah, they just want to be like, you know, US government comes knocking and they're like, look, we don't select the transactions in the block.
Yeah.
Like, we just don't do that. That's not our job. Go to the hundreds of thousands of individual miners, which is basically saying like FBI boy, like go pound sand.
Right. Yeah. So how does, like, when does Stratum V2, because they're like a vote?
There's no vote. No, because there doesn't need to be a vote.
It's just an adoption.
Individuals can adopt it. Like one mining pool could adopt it. It doesn't need, it's not the case that everybody
needs to adopt. It's not one CPU, one vote.
Not one CPU, one vote.
Our Lord and Savior Satoshi, imagine.
That's right, yeah.
What would the founding fathers think, Casey?
Of what?
Of Stratum V2. Or of no one CPU, one vote.
They hated democracy.
No, they literally said many times the founding fathers. Satoshi.
Oh, okay.
Like our founding father.
He would like it because he likes decentralization. He's just very confused about it. He hadn't been black-pilled on democracy yet.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, it's just who knows. I don't know. I'd give it like 4 years, slow transition over the next 4 years, maybe in about, I think some places are already using it. I mean, it does have benefits. So I'd say like, probably within the next couple years, it's going to be really ready for use. Mm-hmm. And then over the next 2 years after that, it's going to start getting rolled out a bit more and more. So I'd say within 4 years, we'll probably be looking pretty good for Stratum V2. That's nice. That's my forecast.
That's your forecast prediction.
Yeah.
I can check the astrology. Mm-hmm. Do you think Stratum V2 has a natal chart?
We could try to figure out when. It'd be hard to pin down the event of when Stratum V2 was born.
Right. No Genesis block.
No Genesis block. Mm. Probably just some nerd in the Czech Republic, like typing code.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe a little hard to do an astrological verification of your prediction.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We can just go with yours.
Yeah, let's just, it's fine. Yeah. Yeah, and that's mining. And mining, the main input to mining is, I mean, if you and me wanted to start a mining operation, Hell Money Podcast Mines, HMPM, we would go out, we'd buy some miners. They're just like these like shoe boxes. We'd get some space, ideally a space with cheap electricity. We'd get our full node because we're going to mine solo, and we would have our full node construct block templates and give it to our mining hardware, which would then roll those nonces until we found a golden nonce and thus a valid block. And then we'd collect our block rewards. And the block template that we would create would just pay us. Like the way that the miner collects their rewards is they just, when they create the Coinbase transaction, they just send the output of the Coinbase transaction to an address that they control. Mm-hmm. And if we wanted to do a pool, then, well, instead of running our own Bitcoin core node, we would be requesting block templates from the pool and rolling nonces on those.
I want a Bitcoin mining heated greenhouse. That's my goal. That's my goal these days.
Absolutely. Once you need a greenhouse, like that would be a cool project. Mm-hmm. And you can also, in that case, it doesn't really matter how efficient it is.
No, it's like serving another purpose.
Yeah. So you could be slightly less efficient than.
I'm trying to orange pull my dad on getting a Bitcoin mining heater for the garage because he's like, it's too cold in there in the winter. I need to figure out something.
The problem is that Bitcoin mines are super loud.
Yeah, that was the issue. But he's also like woodworking with like mass, like classic rock blasting while he's out there. So it's already a pretty loud environment.
Dad sounds like a Chad. Just like making cabinetry while like Metallica plays in the background. Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the time he's playing World of Warcraft.
Dude, I love your dad. Love your dad. So yeah, that's history of Bitcoin mining. That's how mining works. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of connection between Bitcoin mining and electricity because miners are huge consumers of electricity. Mm-hmm. So yeah, miners are out there trying to find the cheapest, most efficient sources of electricity.
Right.
They're mining on electricity that would otherwise be wasted. I think this is one thing that's really important to understand about electricity is not a commodity like grain that we just can kind of ship wherever it's needed.
Move around. Yeah.
Yeah. You can produce grain wherever it's best to produce grain and then just ship it on trucks or boats or trains or whatever to where it's people want it. Mm-hmm. Energy is not like that.
Right.
And we have limited energy transportation capacity. So
and storage.
Yeah, storage. Electricity is very hard to store.
Right.
Batteries are super inefficient. They're super expensive. Transmission capacity needs to be built out. Mm-hmm. So you might have places that are energy rich, but that doesn't mean that you can get that energy anywhere else.
Right. So then you mine Bitcoin there.
You mine Bitcoin.
Where you have a surplus.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
What do people mean when they say like, oh, Bitcoin mining can help stabilize the energy grid?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that just means, so demand on the grid, non-Bitcoin mining energy demands are cyclical over the course of a day.
Right.
It kind of looks like, I don't really know exactly what it looks like, but like during the day, this is like, let's say this is like, 8 a.m. or actually no, this is like 6 a.m. So during the day, like demand for energy increases.
Yeah.
And then I think it peaks like maybe about like 6, 7 p.m. maybe. I don't really know. And then it goes down as people turn it off. And then the cycle continues. So,
right. So, yeah, I mean, as you would expect with people like waking up and using electronics.
That's basically. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And in places that are very hot, the highest period of electricity usage is, I think, in the afternoon.
Yeah. When everybody's there. That's why California is always like sending us emergency alerts being like, hey, guys, can you not use electricity from 4 to 9?
Right.
I'm like, when do you think I use electricity? It's literally 4 to 9.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, those people are morons.
Can you live like a gnome?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm
can
like,
you be more
yay.
European?
Like, I love my cottagecore lifestyle. Thank you, Daddy California.
So one thing about Bitcoin miners is that they're really indifferent to, they can turn off. They don't mind turning off. If a miner turns off 1% of the time, the miner just makes less profit.
Mm-hmm.
1% less profit. This isn't like a hospital where if the hospital turns off 1% of the time, everybody in the ICU dies and it's right. it's like a headline, you know, disaster at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that, and also miners, they consume a lot of electricity and you can communicate with them. The grid can communicate with miners and say, hey, turn off your mining hardware.
How is that different than California telling me to not use electricity from 4 to 9 p.m. and me being like, because no, but you, I want to use it.
Because you care. Like the miners don't really care.
Why don't the miners care? Don't they want to be making maximum profit?
No, but I mean, one thing is that they can also be like, let's say miners buy electricity at like 3 cents a kilowatt hour,
mm-hmm.
right? And they tend to make about 1 cent per kilowatt hour, or like, let's say they even make 3 cents per kilowatt hour on that. So they sell, you know, what they... After accounting for the electricity they use, they make about 3 cents profit per kilowatt hour.
Mm-hmm.
The grid can pay the miners 3 cents per kilowatt hour to curtail their usage.
Mm-hmm.
And the miner is like, this is just as good as mining Bitcoin. I'm turning off my hardware,
sure,
not using electricity and getting paid what I would get paid anyways.
Mm-hmm.
The grid is happy because the grid, all that energy capacity is returned to the grid to all the people and hospitals and air conditioners that you can't just turn off when you need to use them.
Right.
So it's sort of like they call it flexible load. Bitcoin miners are extremely flexible load. They're actually the most flexible load. They can turn on and off like at a moment's notice, like within 30 seconds. You could turn it on, you could turn a whole, you know, building of machines on and off just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the grid can communicate with miners and can either ask them to turn off, they can voluntarily curtail. And they might, one thing that they might do is they might get a special rate on electricity. 90% of the time they get a cheaper rate for turning off that 10% of the time when the grid asks them to.
Right, so some sort of deal basically.
Yep, so miners are flexible load, and one thing that's very popular is unreliable sources of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hydro, wind, and solar. Hydro less so. Hydro is unreliable on a seasonal basis. You have like seasonal peaks and valleys in hydro, but solar and wind are highly unreliable.
Right.
The sun isn't shining very bright today, so the solar panels don't produce much electricity. The wind is not blowing very, very hard today, so the solar panels are not.
Right. It's intermittent.
Yep. And because there's political motivation to use these unreliable sources of energy,
mm-hmm.
It means that it's kind of, Bitcoin can help because you can overbuild these unreliable sources of energy And then when they're consuming and in the on the sunny days and when the wind is blowing hard, your Bitcoin miners are running, making money and offsetting the cost of these paying for electricity and offsetting the cost of this extra capacity. Mm-hmm. And then on the not very windy day or not very sunny day, the Bitcoin miners can turn off and the non-Bitcoin consumers can use the what's remaining of these unreliable energy sources.
Right.
Yep.
So is that what people mean when they say that Bitcoin incentivizes renewables?
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, Bitcoin incentivizes development of energy resources.
Okay.
And they're also very Bitcoin miners are compatible with unreliable energy sources.
Right, right.
Bitcoin miners can also incentivize the finding new sources of electricity. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that like you could actually go and maybe you could build a new power plant and entirely just use Bitcoin miners with it.
Right. So it like makes it more financially incentivized to create more energy, basically.
Yep. And one thing that I don't think people understand or that they sort of demonstrate ignorance of is a lot of the time when there's high demand for something, over time, the cost goes down. Mm-hmm. So for example, if there's low demand for something, not much of it will be produced. If there's low demand for widgets, there's only one widget factory, it's working half time, it makes two widgets a day. Those widgets are actually kind of expensive. Mm-hmm. If there's super high demand for widgets, then at first maybe the price goes up a little bit, but then somebody opens a new widget factory and then another widget factory and then a whole widget technology park with widget research and development,
right,
and research boffins in their mining labs, mm-hmm, or their widget labs. And you know they're opening new widget dust factories in Africa, mm-hmm, which have their own environmental problems, but whatever, we love capitalism. And so... all of a sudden, that's going to drive the price of widgets down. And it might drive it down below the previous cost of widgets when we just had one widget factory because of all the economies of scale of the new widget factories. So you would see, oh my God, there's a lot of demand for widgets, but then these new widget factories and economies of scale in those factories actually driving the price down below the old price. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is also something that can happen with electricity, that you know the increased consumption of electricity actually drives the cost down over the long term as there are investments made in energy production.
Sure.
In response.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand that. I guess for me, I'm like, I'll see what happens. Like, mm-hmm, I'm not as convinced by that argument, but I do think it's like,
yep,
it's valid.
Yep. Yep.
But
it's an argument.
It's, you know, an argument.
Yep. And then also, I mean, another thing is like, for example, stranded natural gas or natural gas that would normally, right, be flared. Mm-hmm. You can profitably just burn it at the wellhead, and that reduces greenhouse gases because instead of venting methane, you're venting CO2.
See, that's what people need to be promoting.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. They need to be like, look, guys,
I mean,
Bitcoin mining fixes this.
The real thing that Bitcoin mining fixes is that we're going to have nuclear energy and Bitcoin mining will incentivize the building of nuclear power plants.
Oh, God.
And also we have this cyclical demand during, mm-hmm, the day, right? Nuclear power plants are not demand responsive.
Yeah. You can't just like power them up and down.
Exactly.
As needed.
They're generating how much energy they're generating,
yeah,
the entire time.
Right.
And so in fact, having Bitcoin miners there to soak up the extra demand, we could have a scenario where, you know, here's the orange is the level of energy that is being generated by the nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. I'll just go handheld,
yeah, go
for a
handheld
moment. And so when this is all being consumed by, you know, businesses, hospitals, people, widget factories, et cetera, mm-hmm, and then all this is being consumed by Bitcoin miners. And so the Bitcoin miners subsidize building these nuclear energy plants, which otherwise there might be too much uneven demand for the nuclear power plants to run profitably.
Sure. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, the future.
The future.
Brave it's going to be world.
Good. You're not pro. You're undecided about nuclear, right? You're like the karmics. I don't know.
Yeah. I just don't know. I would love for... some like spiritual argument for nuclear power. I want like some, like, I don't know. I want some like spiritual asshole on the internet to like tell me why nuclear power is actually like okay karmically.
I mean, it is the core energy source of the universe. You know, stars produce their energy via...
Right, but didn't we already determine that, like, what the sun does is, like, we do, like, a bastardized version of what the sun does? Like, the sun does this, like, pure fission or fusion, and we do fission. I don't remember which is which.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the sun does a fusion.
So...
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, maybe if we could figure out what the sun does, there, then I'd be like, sure, of course.
There are naturally occurring fission reactions.
Yeah, I've heard some...
In, like... uranium deposits in Uganda.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Whatever. It's cool. I get it.
It's cool. I get it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I get that we probably need nuclear and I'll give it up. I'm just, you know, maybe I'm just not cut out for being the ones that make these decisions.
Maybe. Me you neither. Definitely not me either. In fact, nobody's cut out to make these decisions.
Yeah.
Because these systems are too
complicated. We need the invisible hand.
The invisible hand. Yeah. We need a bottom up decentralized decision making.
Right. Yeah. Invisible hands all around the world.
Yep.
Coming together.
So yeah, and I think that's kind of everything.
I think so. That was pretty solid.
Yeah.
Honestly.
So yeah, no craft store mining.
No craft store mining.
No craft store Bitcoin mining.
Yeah. Between my psyche and your description of mining,
yeah,
we had plenty to talk about this episode.
Yeah, and we did do a pretty deep explanation of like how mining works, like piece by piece.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any
call to action
questions about mining or any stones we left unturned?
I don't, but if people have questions, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah. Questions are always much appreciated.
We'll take them.
I love bloviating, you know?
If that's not obvious by now, you're not listening. That's right. Yeah. Okay. And then I guess we should wrap it up.
Cool. Yeah.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening and see you later.
Bye.
Bye.